Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a mini episode of Tides of History. We're trying something a little bit new today. We're going to go over a few things that didn't get into this month's episodes, things that I researched, but which just didn't fit or we didn't have time to go over or had to get cut. So Leah's going to ask me questions about them. I'm going to give you some brief chatter about them. On top of that, we're going to talk a little bit about what I'm reading this month, fun things on the side. So Leah, what are the topics that we're going to go over that didn't make it into our episodes for this month?
As much as I know you really, really are excited about both of these things, I'm sorry they had to get cut, but we're going to talk about the long-term consequences of war in Granada and messianic calls to rulership.
Okay, so what about unintended or long-term consequences of the war in Granada? So, a few things here. We did not have time to talk about this in the episode on the Reconquista because that's where the focus was rather than kind of nittier, grittier details. We'll come back to the bit about messianic destiny a little bit later. So, unintended consequences, long-term consequences of the war in Granada. First, state finance. You know, one of my very favorite topics. So, over the course of the Middle Ages, kingdoms kind of lagged behind city-states in terms of the financial mechanisms that they had access to. This is something that we touched on a few weeks ago. Kingdoms were just less innovative in terms of marshaling resources for the things that they needed to spend money on. City-states had real advantages. They were more compact. They had access to more advanced tools of government. They had better civil services, and they had better representative institutions, which is what you need if you're going to issue something like public debt. That's really important. You need to have buy-in from the people who are actually holding public debt. Now, if you want to fund a really expensive war, long-term public debt is the best way to do that because you can just issue shares on it, pay interest on that, and then you get the cash right away to pay for it. Kingdoms like England, France, and whatnot did not have the fiscal mechanisms necessary to do stuff like this over the course of the Middle Ages. They just were not as efficient with it. Now, as we get into the late 15th century, Spain becomes the first kingdom, the first large-scale political unit in Western Europe to issue a long-standing public debt where they would sell shares and they would provide interest payments on those shares in return for immediate cash. This is a really big development. This is the basis for modern state finance, is a long-term kind of long-standing public debt. Spain was the first kingdom to do it. Why were they the first kingdom to do it? Because they needed to pay for a 10-year war in the Kingdom of Granada. So, the large-scale use of this particular technique of state financing has its roots in Spain in this particular period. They had to do it. As to where they got the idea to do this, it's because there were lots of Italian bankers in Spain, especially Genoese. This is something we talked about in the episodes on Christopher Columbus. We talked about this a little bit on the episode we were taking a tour of Europe. There was a large Genoese expatriate community. There were Florentines. There were Venetians in Spain. There were people who knew how public debt worked, and they were closely connected to the Spanish court. So it was a pretty easy, pretty natural transition to make. I mean, all of that make sense, Leah?
Yeah, I think it does. What is it about city-states? Remind me the rulership of a city-state that allowed them to be more aggressive with their financing practices.
Okay. Well, so city-states, even ones that are oligarchies, they have a broader scale buy-in from the political community, and they still often have representative bodies, even if those representative bodies were not especially effective. So that made it possible to get more buy-in from the citizenry. And they're also just people know each other more. People, like, you're more likely, if you're a member of the oligarchy of Venice, to know the people who are making political decisions than you are in a kingdom as spread out as France is, where only something like the royal court can be your focus. A city-state is just so much more compact, both literally and figuratively, in terms of how it functions. It's easier to mobilize a greater percentage of resources in a smaller scale political environment.
Totally. And then the buy-in for somebody who's like in your backyard instead of somebody who's on the other side of your country and who are more kind of like mythic icons than actual people, I'm sure that's higher.
Yeah. If it's your cousin Giovanni who happens to be the one coordinating the financial outlays in the city of Venice, you're more likely to think, you, rich Venetian, that guy and the government that he represents is trustworthy to make the interest payments.
So then the other question, then, how long does it take Spain to shift to this model? Because it sounds like a really big undertaking to get everybody on board.
They were trying everything. I think that's part of the reason why they did it, is because it started on a pretty small scale at first. It was one of just a whole series of different techniques they were trying, as they desperately needed income. So, for example, Queen Isabella pawned her jewels at various points to pay for these campaigns. That sounds like a big deal, but that's why medieval rulers had jewels, is because they were easily fungible.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's like, the jewels were not just like pretty things that you had. It's like, oh, here's an easy, immediate source of wealth. If you need to pawn them, then you can just do that as a source of ready cash. So the legend about Isabella pawning her jewels for Columbus's voyage, it's like, oh no, that was just a source of finance that was available to late medieval rulers.
So not a huge hardship to then sell these rubies.
No, well, and you would get them back too if you repaid what was effectively a loan. They're just security for a loan, you know?
Interesting.
So there was that. They tried forced loans, which is a kind of a standard technique. They tried a whole bunch of different tax things, sales of indulgences, yet another thing that ended up paying for Columbus's voyage eventually. That was a technique that they pioneered while they were trying to pay for Granada. Because again, this is a crusade and it has papal backing. So it's a religious war. You can sell indulgences as a means of quote unquote funding the crusade. They tried everything, and a long-term interest-bearing public debt was a solution that they hit on as they were kind of desperately scrambling for money to pay for all this.
Okay, that's really interesting. Okay, so you're fighting a war for 10 years and financing it different ways. How does that change the way you're fighting that war then?
So I think the blueprint, the recipe that you get from military innovation, basically all innovation at any point in history, is it's incentive driven, right? And it's where incentive and opportunity meet up. And if you're spending a lot of money on warfare in a very distinct and limited period of time, and you know their circumstances are right for things to innovate, that's what you get. This was one of the main zones of military innovation during this period of history. Another one, something we talked about a couple of months back, was the Burgundian Wars and Charles the Bold. Things happened very quickly because you have a kind of a crucible where ideas are being tested and there's a lot of money being poured into finding solutions for it. That's exactly what we see in Granada. So siege warfare reaches its kind of mature late medieval form during the campaigns to conquer Granada, because you have a whole bunch of fortified strong places, you have cannon, you have expert people who know how to use those cannon. There are a lot of incentives bringing those people there. A lot of foreign technical mercenaries come to Granada, like English artillerymen, Swiss mercenaries, German cannon founders, all make their way to Spain in order to reap the benefits and the rewards of fighting in this campaign, spiritual and material, you know, like it's a crusade, like, yay, we get to unburden our souls. So all of this makes it a zone of military innovation. Now, that would be interesting in its own right, but it has really important long-term consequences, because the Spanish monarchs went straight from fighting this war in Granada to fighting the first phase of the Italian Wars. Some of the same soldiers and commanders who were fighting during the war in Granada immediately get sent to Italy to fight the French. So that then becomes the next major zone of military innovation and military expenditure, is the Italian Wars. So you get a whole bunch of people who are really experienced, who are flexible, who are used to thinking in different ways about warfare and what the situation requires, and you just move them straight from one massive conflict that's getting a ton of resources expended on it to the next one. So one of the innovations that comes out of this is a standing army.
I was going to ask, because you have a unified kingdom, you have a strong rulers in charge of a unified kingdom, able to control it, a bunch of money coming in, a public debt system, a way to pay these guys, and then you're just rolling them into the next thing. That sounds like a pretty modern country.
Exactly. That's exactly what you get. You hit on exactly the innovations that produce a standing army. The Spanish armies of the 16th century and beyond were fearsome. They eventually turned to a mixture of pikes and gunpowder, and the mixture that you get is called a tercio. And nobody wanted to fight the tercios in the 16th century. Up into the middle of the 17th century, nobody wanted to fight the tercios because they're well paid. They're really experienced. The systems by which they were recruited, it was a mixture of conscription and volunteers, but they knew what they were doing. They were really good at this. And that military tradition begins with the war in Granada, like just this really intense period of well-funded warfare where there are a lot of incentives, especially for the kind of like mid-level and upper-level commanders. Like, there's a lot of continuity, you know? There's a lot of people who are learning war as a trade and a craft under really challenging conditions, but they're being paid and incentivized to do that. We see all of this beginning in Granada.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Who's like number two at this time if Spain is like superpower?
So Spain is the emerging superpower, but otherwise it's France because
France.
Just population and size.
Yeah.
You know, France is pretty densely populated. It's an enormous kingdom. You look at France on a European map and you're like, oh, wow, that's a lot
huge.
Of territory. And you have long traditions of royal power. Like the French monarchs are pretty good at mobilizing resources to do the things they want to do when those monarchs are competent, as they are for most at the end of the 15th century. Things get a little bit squirrely in France in the middle of the 16th century with the wars of religion there, which we'll talk about way down the road in this show, probably toward the end of 2019 or beginning of 2020.
Ugh, but future.
Yeah.
That's really far.
That's a long way into the future. But the French state came out of the Hundred Years' War as one of the strongest and most advanced in Europe, and they were the first to do the whole standing army thing. They understood, the French rulers of this period understood how to make a state run and what would make it competitive with its rivals. And, you know, they were good at it.
Okay, so we have this war in Granada that's basically shaping all of Europe for centuries to come.
Yes. Yeah, it's in really kind of unintended ways, the war in Granada has long-term consequences. Yeah, and this is something that we touched on in the Spanish Inquisition episode, is it made Ferdinand and Isabella really prestigious. Mm-hmm. Like that other rulers were like, oh, wow, they're doing really important and cool things. I mean, those things don't seem cool to us.
Oh,
but
that's cool. No, that is interesting because they're some of the preeminent names, at least in like European histories and that's taught in schools. Like everybody knows Ferdinand and Isabella, but to hear them also respected and known widely by their peers is a huge sign of competence.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of the late medieval mindset is that glory matters, you know, like if you can, and piety matters, like public religious devotion is an important thing, to be seen doing the things that kings were supposed to do, winning battles, conquering things, and doing so in the service of God. Other people were going to view that in an incredibly positive light. And so, you know, in the Spanish Inquisition episode, I talked about this. It's like, it all seems a little bit grab baggy, but it's not. It all comes together in the reputation of the Catholic monarchs and in their vision and design for what they wanted to do.
That seems like a perfect time to talk about messianic rulership.
Yes. So that is, for a variety of reasons, a really big deal around the end of the 15th century. I'm sure that there are people who have hypothesized as to why it is that right around this time, messianic rulership is such a big deal. It's not like this had never happened before in the Middle Ages, but you get a real confluence of kings who think that they're kind of messianic rulers at the end of this period. There's a long apocalyptic tradition in the Middle Ages, talking about the end of the world and what it was going to take to bring it about. It gets kind of renewed in popularity toward the end of the Middle Ages. That's one of the currents of late medieval religion, is there's some apocalypticism running in there. We see that blossom with one strand of the Protestant Reformation in a little while. It's not like that came out of nowhere. That was a strand of late medieval religious thought. But it gets combined in really interesting ways with ideologies of royal power and a sense of kind of emerging national histories in this period. Mm-hmm. So
that's new.
Yeah, we see this really strongly with Isabella and Ferdinand, is they had a strong sense of Castile's, of the past of Spain, of Castile especially, as this kind of God's chosen kingdom, and that played into their view of what they thought the future was supposed to look like too. If it was their destiny to bring Castile to the forefront of European kingdoms, that was because Castile had a greater destiny, the greater destiny being to reconquer the Holy Land and bring about the last days and the final judgment.
Okay. And that's like, we've talked a lot on this show about kind of like a personal history and personal legacy. And with that being, you know, a driver of people, all these rulers kind of grabbing land, grabbing all this money wherever they can. So then when you have this shift towards rulers who are more, you know, reliant on the public, relying on people to fund them, on these armies, and having this like unified space. Okay, so how does all this play into this idea of royal propaganda and public support?
Okay, so in this period, rulers want to and need to reach out to their publics in way that they didn't before, in ways that they did not before. And it's possible for them to do so in new ways because of the printing press, among other things. This is the first great era of propagandist monarchs. You know, Maximilian, whom we talked about a few weeks ago, is the great hand at this, you know, that you can use the printing press, you can mass produce propaganda, a particular vision of what you're doing and a particular kind of line of reasoning. It's very basic political communication, but it's a lot of it is new in this period. The ability to reach more people is new. So, you know, like when Henry VII of England marries or wins at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485, and when he marries Princess Elizabeth, they commandeer basically every printing press in England to put out the word of this. You know what I mean? Like they're trying to present a particular vision of themselves as rulers. The printing press plays into the messianic thing because it allows you to reach a broader public than you could have beforehand. So there's a new kind of audience for royal propaganda. But I'm not sure that's actually the driving force behind the messianic thing. I think it's just all of these things are coming together, this kind of apocalyptic religious view, these increasingly powerful kings. Kings need to tell themselves that they're doing it all for a reason. Like kings have always sought out power and territory and, you know, more land, more revenue, more. You kind of have to tell yourself you're doing that for something. Mm-hmm. And here, right here, is this beautiful justification for anything you could possibly do. So I think that's part of it, because it's not just Isabella and Ferdinand. King Charles VIII saw himself as the warrior king of the last days. King Manuel of Portugal was also really steeped in this kind of messianic tradition. It's part of the reason he sends Vasco da Gama to India, is because they want to outflank Islam. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to get to the rear of Islam, and they want to make an alliance with Prester John, the legendary supposedly Christian king of the Far East. Make an alliance with him, and they'll attack Islam from behind. So all of this is kind of tied up with the residue of crusading. It's tied up with this rising sense of apocalypticism in Christian society more generally, and with the rising power of kings. So it's this stew. But then, yeah, you do have the ability to communicate it more to the masses, and you need more buy-in from them because you're asking more of them. So it all kind of ties together. I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but...
No, it does. Here's my next question then. What does the next, like, 50 years or so look like? We're in the late Middle Ages, so then what do we have to look forward to? And do these messianic rulership, does that tradition last outside the Middle Ages?
It plays in a little bit, but I think it gets derailed by a lot of other things. There's a kind of, at the beginning of the 16th century, we see this most clearly with Machiavelli, there's a new kind of tradition of straightforward power politics that comes out of all this. Those are Machiavelli's observations born of the age that he's living in. There are other strands of political thought. We get the beginnings of the concept of absolutism, of real divine right monarchs.
I remember that.
all power to the monarch. Like that is every bit, and in fact, much more influential than Machiavelli's ideas ever were during Machiavelli's lifetime and beyond. But so you get new strands of political thought. The apocalyptic messianism thing, there's a reason why we don't talk about it that much, and I think it's because it flames out pretty quickly. Charles V still sees himself. You know, we talked about Charles V in the Spanish Inquisition episode at the very end. We'll talk about him more again. He's the most powerful ruler of the 16th century, maybe of any European period. Charles V has a sense of kind of messianic destiny about him, but it's not quite as apocalyptic.
Sure.
I don't think.
But it's really easy to see now, kind of understanding that the next step does seem, absolutism makes total sense as a next step. Mm-hmm. If you have these kings who see themselves as gods, or at least in some divinely inspired tradition, absolutism mm-hmm. makes total sense as the next phase.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what we see. Like there's a tradition of political philosophy that begins in France, or a development of a tradition of political philosophy that starts to make those cases much more explicitly in the first few decades of the 16th century. So things just go kind of a slightly different direction in the history of thought, but it's there. It's there for it.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Yeah, but in terms of what the next few decades look like, much more, even more violent, more bloody, wars are larger scale, states are doing more things, and you have kind of a towering generation of rulers. Like I think the rulers at the end of the 15th century get a lot of credit as state builders, and it's their children, the next generation of rulers, who really start to explore the full capabilities of those states. So Ferdinand and Isabella do a lot of state building and a lot of fighting, but it's their grandson and successor, Charles V, who really turns those to the most violent possible purposes. Henry VII builds a lot in England. It's Henry VIII who takes that to the next level. So this is a foundation for what follows. Like we think the wars at the end of the 15th century were something. Well, the Italian wars are on an entirely different scale. It's everything gets stepped up a notch in terms of the scale of fighting, the scale of political action, the scale of state building.
Sounds like business as usual on Tides of History.
Yeah, it's going to be some interesting times. We're going to get into that in the next few months.
Patrick, I have no further questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Just kidding. I lied. I have one more question. I want to know what you're reading.
I am reading a history of post-Napoleonic Europe. It's a history of kind of the long 19th century from 1815 to 1914. It's called The Pursuit of Power. It's by a historian named Evans. It is one of the Penguin Histories of Europe. It's really excellent. I recommend it. It's very long.
I was going to say, I've never seen this book nor heard of it, but it sounds like a lot.
It's very long. It's longer than an Oxford History of the United States. But as somebody who doesn't know much about 19th century Europe, within reason, relatively speaking, I think I still probably know a fair bit about 19th century Europe.
I think that's probably true.
As somebody who doesn't have a lot of detailed specialist knowledge of that period, I would like to know more. And that's why I'm reading this very long book, which I highly recommend. It's very good. I'm about halfway through it. I think you'll all like it.
And you're reading this for fun?
For fun-ish, yeah.
Okay, Patrick, for real this time, no further questions.
Thank you, Leah. Thanks for joining me. You asked very good questions today. I appreciate it. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show and send us your questions at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.